people, I am a morning person, and kind of self-declaring that so that they know generally I am that enthusiastic person. I'm up at seven, like actually working from seven, I'm up before that.
Yeah.
And people know that. And I try and do my, I like my LinkedIn stuff. I schedule a lot of my posts, but I try and do that in the morning because my brain is the most sharp.
I'm the same as well. And there's a lot of thought, isn't there, that say that you should do like kind of creative work in the morning, you know, creative before kind of anything else. And so I try and do that as well. You know, if I'm ever writing anything, it's in the morning.
I read could be pop science, but sort of that there is some evolutionary reasons why some people are morning people and some people are late, which is to do with, you know, like protecting the tribe.
So what would you be in the tribe, Clem?
Well, I'd be the person that is staying up later, looking out for people over, you know, later on while other people have gone to sleep.
So it's just literally about trying to have cover almost
24 hours. So some people have sort of evolved to be up early and other people are later. For that, those kind of reasons. Like I say, how they know that or whether it's pop science, I don't know.
And what about the early people then? Would they be the ones like going out hunting, gathering, foraging? Or...
Well, again, it's just like shifts in a way. So they would do that earlier.
Yeah.
Then, you know, so it sounds like both of you are sharpest in the morning. I'm sharpest in the afternoon. So
just
covering the period of the day kind of thing. So
just makes sense.
Yeah. So that's the kind of, that's the theory that I read. There's some reasons behind why that might be.
Interesting.
I know.
Interesting. I like it. We obviously just chatted away, which is great. It's great to do. So, Rachel, I suppose for anybody listening or watching, it'd be nice to just introduce yourself just tell us a bit about yourself.
Cool. Okay, so I'm Rachel.
Yeah.
I'm currently a head of technology working in data. I have a background that might not be your conventional background into technology. I actually have a degree in archaeology and anthropology, and I am a trained primary school teacher. I've been in technology for a good few years now, and I'm really, really keen on learning, growing, developing, and ultimately being the best leader that I can be, because I got into leadership because I was really passionate about the role that leaders play in the lives of their teams, and how actually, if you're serious about being a leader and growing, it is, I think, your responsibility to really embrace that, even if you are an accidental leader. And there's absolutely no problem in that. I think that's quite, you know, that everybody has their own journeys. But then once you're a leader, you have that responsibility. So that's me.
No, that's interesting. I think the accidental leader is an interesting one, isn't it? I think I certainly fell into that camp. Like my first leadership role, somebody said, I'm hiring somebody and they're going to be working with you and it's going to be your responsibility for that. And yeah, I was very much in your camp of, oh, that's my responsibility. I really want to make sure that I do the best possible job for that person. But it was never an intention of mine to be a leader. Yeah. What about you, Claire?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I got an opportunity to move into kind of a team lead or manager role reasonably early in my career. But I think I already kind of knew I quite like that. I like interacting with people. I like trying to support people and help them develop and things. So I I was beginning to get a bit bored with writing code, if I'm honest, which is what I was doing beforehand. Yeah. So it was probably not something I didn't apply for it. Again, it was a growing company. And then somebody said, oh, we think you'd be good to sort of take on the lead role for the team. And great. Okay. Yeah. Just sort of got stuck in, really. So
yeah, interesting. And you like telling people what to do as well?
Well, that's an interesting one. No, I know, but it's a good point about leadership, isn't it? Because is leadership telling people what to do? That's an interesting thought.
Well, we were chatting about this before, Rachel, weren't we? About your first foray into coaching.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I did a training course as part of my leadership development. Yeah. I thought, wow, this is exciting, a new way that I can work with the people in my team. I should go out, I should learn about this. So I did. I think it was a couple of days. And so I landed back at work with my team and I was like, right, I'm going to implement this. And I had a one-to-one with one of my principal engineers and I launched straight into coaching. What I thought was coaching. Turned out it wasn't coaching. He kind of stopped me about 10 minutes into this conversation and said, Rach, just checking with you. I feel like I'm being interviewed right now. So I was like, oh, God, okay, maybe not. This is not what I was going for. This is not, I don't think this is coaching. So I had to draw myself back and take a bit of a step back, because I think I'd interpreted that coaching was, oh, I've got to have the best questions in the moment, the most witty questions, and be the most kind of, you know, on an intelligent person in that conversation. I kind of missed the whole point of coaching is not making it about you.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? I think I've shared this somewhere previously. I don't think it was on one of our kind of podcasts, but I had a very similar thing. So my first foray into coaching quite a long time ago was I'd had a bit of training in a leadership training course, not a full coaching kind of qualification that I did later on. And it was, again, it's kind of question based. And, you know, the purpose, obviously, is, you know, asking good questions allow people to become a bit more resourceful, work through it themselves. And actually, you know, it is a very, you know, important part of the technique of coaching. And so I'd had a little bit of training on this, and I thought, oh, that's great. I was used to being like this kind of like fountain of knowledge within kind of the team, where people would come to me and I'd give them the answer and I'd feel great about it. And so I switched to a questioning style, but I didn't tell anybody that I was going to do it. The first lady I did it with, after about a minute, she was just getting really frustrated. And she was like, I just need the answer. Can you help me, please? And I was like, oh. And then I kind of realized a little bit that actually, look, we need to give a bit of preamble around this and actually say, look, this is why I'm doing it. This is what the benefit will be. And you know, hopefully it will help you in the future doing it as well. So it was quite, so my mind fell flat on its face quite nicely as well.
Yeah, I guess the thing that springs to mind for me is, which I think I was guilty of doing in the past, which is thinking you're coaching, but you're actually still giving advice by just turning things into questions. Yeah. They're actually, one of the people who taught on my coach training called them quigestions. Yeah. So you're sort of, you know, basically phrasing something as a question, but you're still sort of telling them what to do. You know, do you think it would be a good idea to maybe do this training course?
Yeah, so like leading them down.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yes, I think it would. Yeah. Ah, great. Yeah. I've coached them into doing that. Well, maybe not. So, yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, I think phrasing things as questions, I guess, could be, depending on how it's done, come across like interviewing somebody, or you can sort of subtly give advice still through questions. I guess there's lots more nuance to it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So what, from your side, Rachel, because you said you're kind of like passionate about learning and the leadership side of things, what's, you know, from leaders that you've had, what's kind of been the best kind of leadership advice you've had?
Oh my gosh. That's such a difficult question, because I don't think I have one particular thing because my career has evolved with each phase of it. So with each kind of area that I've worked in, each team I've looked after, worked with, led, each domain I've worked with, it's evolved. And at every point in that journey, I've worked with different people. I've had different mentors, different coaches, different sponsors. And I think that from each one of those people, I've learned something different.
Yeah.
And that's been really, really powerful. So I don't think I have one particular thing other than just kind of what leadership is.
Yeah.
Perhaps. So I'm a firm believer, and this comes from actually a particular training course called Leadership Beyond the Theory, which is amazing, by the way. But it's about defining leadership as leader set the standard pace and tone. So for every leader, that might be very different.
Yeah.
But that for me was really powerful, because I was kind of looking around going, what even is a leader? What am I even doing here?
Yeah.
What should I be?
Yeah.
And that's really helped me. So every time things have changed for me, I've kind of kept hold of that and thought, well, in this particular role, this is my standard pace and tone.
Yeah.
And back to what you were saying about coaching and introducing change to your team when you're going to change the way that you're going to work, perhaps, and kind of highlighting that. I think also being clear with your team what you, as the leader in that moment, what your standards, pace, and tone are, not making people guess, is quite a useful way I found, anyway, of signposting.
Yeah, Okay.
What do you think?
Would that also require the leaders to sort of adapt for certain contexts or situations, so change the pace or the standards?
Yeah, definitely.
What do we mean by standards and pace and tone? Tell us a little bit more about that.
So pace, for me,
mm-hmm.
if you've got perhaps a particular deliverable that you need to get done within a certain time frame,
yep.
And I'm certainly not saying that you would just, you know, put pressure on a group of people to achieve a certain outcome. You look at how much capacity you actually had and you think about that as a leader. Yep. But your pace for that particular period of time might be quite high. And I think as a leader, you know, acknowledging that and saying to your team, like, folks, we've got this, you know, really exciting, wildly important goal that we're going after. You know, I'm going to work with you, we're going to work together on this, but we're going to get through this, and it's, you know, we're really going to feel proud and excited about the fact that we've got this goal. The pace might be higher than perhaps when we're not delivering that wildly important goal. I think, you know, you've got to be careful because you've got to maintain a good pace. I think standards, just going back to that quickly. I appreciate the fact that, you know, I'm hogging the microphone here, but standards, whether you know it, whether you believe it or not, the standards you project as a leader will impact the standards that your team think are normal. So if I rock up at 11 o'clock unplanned, don't communicate that, you know, like I'm arriving at 11 o'clock, but, you know, like my time has just slipped and, you know, it's just unfortunate. And this is how, you know, we as a team act. I think that sets a standard for the team that you might not want.
I don't know if that's your question.
And I think the pace one's an interesting one for me as well. So, you know, in my other life outside of coaching and podcasting, we're in like the recruitment kind of consultancy world. You've obviously got a consultancy kind of background, and often that's very fast paced, often very reactive, and often kind of competitive in terms of you need to deliver something competing against somebody else. So often it's a very kind of frantic kind of pace, kind of all the time. And I've definitely seen that from kind of like a leadership perspective, that you see people can definitely get a bit burnt out with that if they're not used to kind of working at that type of pace. And also, if you are a type of individual who doesn't particularly enjoy working at a fast pace, it probably isn't an industry that's suited to you, if that makes sense as well. So it's an interesting one to kind of manage from a, you know, if you look at it from a holistic perspective of productivity, kind of well-being for people, and actually, you know, that overall piece of leadership, actually helping people not to burn out, be as productive as they possibly can, but in the long term rather than just in the short term as well. So it is quite an interesting one that I think it maybe crosses across different industries and in different kind of ways as well, if that makes sense. So if you're not acutely aware of that kind of pace, you can definitely lead to problems. And also there can be people who just don't work fast enough within the, you know, if you've got like a project deadline or something, and somebody who can't kind of hack that pace, you know, from a leadership perspective, do you have to make a tough call sometimes and go, look, they're not the right person for that project?
It's a good question. What do you think, Clem? No, I genuinely really want to know.
What I was thinking there was the value of models, I guess, like standards, pace and tone, is it's helping, it's providing leaders something, some sort of framework to reflect against.
Yeah.
You know, so actually kind of consider, in this case, those three things. What should I be saying in terms of standards? So it's bringing it into people's kind of conscious thought as a leader. This is my role to set standards. What am I expecting of the team?
Yeah.
How can I be clear about that? What's the pace we currently need? What else is maybe going on in people's lives that might not allow them to meet that pace? Is that going to be a problem?
Yeah.
How could we accommodate? You know, those kind of things. And then the tone as well is a really interesting one for me. What leaders say and how they phrase things and the choice of words or the tone of, you know, of it is, has such an impact that I think lots of people don't really even consider. And often it's sort of, I guess, another angle of accidental is sometimes people think, I have no idea why that's happened like that. And it's just because of the way they put something across.
Do you know what? It is so interesting that I think the being purposeful with what you say and how you show up as a leader is actually much more important than I perhaps gave it. Yeah, it's much more important than I thought it was when I first kind of came into the role. And over time, you learn it more and more. And I think some people naturally show up quite well. And actually, you have people who are quite who are naturally quite good leaders, set good standards and tone and maybe pace and just actually just portray that. And sometimes those type of people get almost fall into leadership roles because they are kind of acting in that kind of way. But I certainly find the first time I took an actual ND type role leading a business, that you're expected to be the face of the business, show up at the town halls and, you know, communicate what the business is doing. And actually, like, the first time you do it, you really think, oh, well, I was really quite nervous, but I was actually, how do I actually do this? How do I deliver it in a way that will communicate what we're trying to do? And was probably terrible at it for the first 10 or 15 times. And I'm not saying I've got that much better at it, but I think you learn over practice and you, again, if you reflect and you have more awareness, then you do, you know, having these type of conversations helps you improve that as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. I think being aware and being invested in actually learning and improving is the important thing there for me, because nobody's perfect. Yeah. Nobody is the finished them.
Yeah.
And so we've all got the opportunity, I think, to really think about, you know, what could I be doing better? How could I be doing better? And then reaching out for support when we identify that. And we might not actually know what we should be improving. And I think then asking for feedback and leaning into that is really, really, really important.
Yeah.
It can be quite scary because you put yourself in a vulnerable position, but I do believe that that is really important.
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly had feedback in the past that I've gone, oh, wow, okay. But I've been the better for it because I've had that feedback and then I've had the chance to be able to learn from it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I think that's really interesting.
What feedback have you had? I'll share some of mine as well.
Okay, cool. I'll share one particular piece of feedback that I actually received from one of my directs quite recently. So I have a habit, and this I think transcends my work and my home life. I'm not a very patient person.
Okay.
I'm quite interested in we're moving on, we're going towards the next thing. I'm quite ambitious and I'm actually quite competitive, if I'm being completely honest.
Mm-hmm.
So I find, especially with Zoom calls, that when I'm finished the call, I will end the call. And sometimes that's a little bit too soon for people. They haven't quite finished what they needed to discuss. We've not had the end of the call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thank you, everybody. And because they've been meetings that I've set up, I've also had the power to end meeting for all.
Yeah.
So that kind of blunt, Rachel's ended the call. And we've got to the stage now with my team, it's kind of become a bit of a running joke that this is what Rachel sometimes does. I'm getting better.
Yeah.
I'm trying to pause a bit more. I find it really awkward, if I'm honest. But
do you do it on phone calls as well?
Yeah, terrible for phone calls. But because now a lot of the conversations I have are on Zoom, it's kind of more obvious, you know, Rachel's done, ended the call.
So if you'd get up and leave today, then we know what it is. That's interesting. It's interesting. But I think my initial take from that, which is quite interesting, I think it's interesting, is that someone in your team has felt safe enough to give you that feedback and that you've taken it on board. You're having a joke about it. We're talking about it now.
Mm.
I think there's plenty of teams where that will be known that somebody's like that, but they wouldn't share it with the manager.
Yes.
I don't know what you think.
Absolutely, people might feel afraid to raise it.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing that popped into my head is, not everybody would take it on board. So some people would go, well, of course, that's how we're not wasting time here. And then give it no further thought. I will just abruptly end every meeting.
Yeah.
As opposed to kind of thinking, okay, well, this feels a bit uncomfortable, but I wonder if there are reasons why other people might benefit from that. So it's that learning and growth, I agree, is just so important as a leader.
Yeah. And we've talked about feedback a lot, haven't we? We run quite a few sessions on it, and you know, mm-hmm. I call you the feedback ninja because you didn't run these courses, Claire. And so one of the things that I learned from you, which or I suppose we are kind of reflected on, and I've taken on board, is that so initially when you talk about kind of feedback, often you talk about as the manager or leader giving feedback to somebody else.
Yes.
But then there's the higher levels of it, of actually receiving feedback yourself, and then kind of creating a culture that is an open and safe, psychologically safe environment where everybody can have peer-to-peer feedback and you know, a bit like you've had with yourself, feel open and free to have that kind of conversation with it. And you know, there's these different kind of levels of it, and it can probably go even higher if we get a bit philosophical with it. But I find it kind of fascinating when I reflect back on different environments that I've been in with different kind of people who've been either working for me in the past, or I've worked for other people where I've certainly not felt safe enough to give that kind of feedback, or not brave enough as a leader to give it as well. So, so I think that's testament to you, Rachel, that people are giving you that.
I tell you what, it's a really good point, though. If you are a leader and you have a team, well, you can be a leader without a team, but I'm talking specifically if you've got a team, people reporting into you, and one of those people does take the time, has the gumption to give you feedback.
I
think that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing for them. They are an individual that actually, if they have taken the time to do that and they have the courage.
Yeah.
That's great. But yeah, the environment, it is proof that you have an environment that actually people feel safe enough.
Yeah.
And this particular individual who gave me the feedback is the most observant person I've ever worked with. He's absolutely got the superpower of being able to completely listen and absorb a lot of what goes on in the subtext of things. And so when he gave me this feedback, I was like, wow, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Because even my family haven't. Okay. So no expectation that any of them are watching this, but.
Yeah. Have you spoken to your family about it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And at home.
How did they react?
Oh, they were like, yeah. You've been doing this for years.
We've never wanted to mention it.
Yeah, awkward. Yeah. I think it's just been a running joke. I think it's been one of those things that actually, at home, it's just like, well, that's Rach.
Yeah.
She just does that. But when you apply that in a leadership context or a work context, suddenly the impact is greater.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So I said I'd share one of mine. So one of the bits of feedback I got, and it was actually when I was doing my coach training course, was that I talk too much. And for a coach, that's terrible, because it's more asking questions, listening. It's about the other person and it's in service of them trying to help it. And again, I then mentioned that to other people and it was quite similar as well. And actually, when I reflect on it, I know I do. I am a talker. Like some people are more naturally a listener. Some people are more naturally a talker. And so it's one of those that I've tried really hard since to then try and listen more. But even when we do this, I'll end up talking quite a lot because I like it.
But at least you're aware and you've had the opportunity, haven't you, to understand, and then you can do with that what you want to.
It's very true. And I think, again, going back to leadership skills, right? So listening is a superpower in leadership, in my opinion, and it's taken me quite a long time to understand it. And the coaching's really helped with that. I think we were chatting before, I think, about somebody that you know who used to interview by talking at somebody for 45 minutes and then say, great work, you're on board, and then come in. And I know people who are a bit like that as well. Interestingly, I believe that my interviewing skills have got much better over time with becoming much better at listening.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to get your thoughts on the kind of talking versus listening in leadership.
Balance. I think it's all about balance. So sometimes there is a time when, as a leader, you need to make a decision, you need to give your teams the clarity. And in that moment, if you just continue to listen and you keep explaining the situation and going over and over and you don't move forward, that's not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you've got to get that balance right between, I think, listening and being curious for just a bit longer than you might be comfortable with.
Yeah.
To really understand what is going on. And that is incredibly hard when there is a huge amount of pressure around you. You know, you might be in the middle of an incident, you might be in the middle of an issue. But understanding at the start as much as possible will pay dividends throughout. I think that's a bit of balance. And I'm not saying I get it right, but I definitely try and make sure that I'm conscious of that balance.
Fantastic.
What do you think?
Yeah, I very much agree with the balance thing. That's for me, that's a, I guess, a core value, everything in balance. That taking anything to an extreme is likely to be challenging. And in fact, that reminds me of a typical exercise they do on coach training is they get you to do a really difficult exercise where you literally have to listen to somebody for 10 minutes and you're not allowed to say anything. All you can say is, and go on.
Yeah.
You know, or something along those lines, or tell me more.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult because we're just not used to listening without being able to kind of interject or come back with something ourselves. So yeah, balance is really important. The thing I, there's an acronym, WAIT, Why Am I Talking, which I often introduce to leaders if they've not come across it. Yeah. So, and again, I guess it's about that conscious thought. Why am I talking? Do I need to be talking here? Has the other person got more to say? I'll actually pause. And there's a kind of practical thing. Put your tongue in the roof of your mouth. Maybe count to three.
Ooh.
Allow the space to see if the other person fills it before jumping in. So I definitely agree. There's times to be decisive. There's times when it's infuriating for people if all you keep doing is asking them questions.
Yeah.
And actually, they just want to be told the answer or have your take on it. But I think for me, it's about giving them space to do their thinking first and see where that takes them. And then if when they sort of when you get to the point where they're actually going, well, what do you think? OK, well, what I think is this, that and the other.
Mm.
So that's the kind of, I guess, how I try to approach it. And again, get it wrong lots of times.
But I think it's about being conscious, isn't it? Because you are conscious of it. And I love that WAIT idea. I think that's great. I'm definitely going to start using that. I think our attention is pulled in so many different directions now. Like our smartphones, our computers, you know, most people have got two screens going on. I can tell you, though, people do notice. If you're looking at two screens and you're having a one-on-one with them and you're looking at something else, that it's not the same kind of conversation that you might have if you genuinely focus on them. So my top tip actually on that I've come across is hide things like the self view, because that's distracting. I personally don't want to see myself while I'm talking to somebody else. I get that there are reasons why people might want that because they're conscious of, you know, how I might be presenting, but I find that helps with my distraction levels. Turn off the other screen, put your phone down, and just listen to people. And I'd be trying to do this more in my home life as well, because again, I think we have the same conversations sometimes, and that's perhaps because we're not listening to each other as much as we could.
100%. Yeah, the being fully present with somebody is massively, it's so important. I was smiling and laughing about the self-screen thing. I think, you know, I was going in my head, maybe I'm too vain looking at myself on there. I like looking at myself on the screen. But you're right, it's an absolute distraction, isn't it? It's like me looking in the mirror, oh, my hair doesn't look great today. Oh, what were you saying? Yeah, so, but from a pure coaching perspective, I think this is, we've chatted about this before, and I don't think I've shared it, but so I'm quite into actually meditation and yoga, and for that reason of trying to be a lot more present in things, certainly in my role previously before being with Exalto, I found I was just getting pulled left, right and center all over the place, and I wasn't being present with my family and kids and stuff, and actually let's try and calm and get a little bit more balance back into it. So before doing a coaching session, I'll always do a 5-minute meditation so that I'm fully present with the person, because it is in service of that person.
Yeah.
And actually just trying to take kind of like mindful breaks or whatever you do, you know, I like running and other things as well, and things that just set you back, just being fully present before going into something. So I've got a brain that's kind of a bit all over the place as well. So I need those resets sometimes. So like exercise is a bit of a superpower thing for me to get myself back into that. And I've got the luxury of, because it's our own company, that I can manage my own time a little bit, but it can be a little bit harder if you're on other people's times and agendas with that.
Yeah, that's true. But I still think, though, that you can carve out time. So things like, I love coffee.
Me too. Yeah.
So obsessed with coffee. Really nice coffee really makes my day.
Mm-hmm.
But just taking that as an opportunity to pause and not drinking my coffee with my phone.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just, yeah, I'm very, very conscious of things like my phone and the pull of things like, I mean, LinkedIn, I think, is great for many reasons, but you can get totally sucked into it.
Yeah. Do you do the mindful coffee making? Do you have a coffee machine?
I do have a coffee machine.
So, and do you do the mindful one of like setting it? So somebody taught me this. Have you heard about this as well?
I have, and I got to admit, I kind of do it on occasion.
Oh, cool.
Well.
Okay. Yeah.
So you can tell me your version of it, but the version I was told of it is, it's kind of, again, losing all distractions. Mm-hmm. So no other people around, no kids, no distractions, no dogs. TV off, phone away. And then it's, if you've got the full shebang, it's like the beans out, smelling, taking some time to smell the beans, grinding them, smell them again, actually putting them into the I can't remember what it's called, and then just scraping off and then doing it, and then actually taking time to savour it. So maybe it's a 10-minute kind of like ritual of it, but it's like a reset that helps you go before going into your day. That's what I...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I do some of what you've said there.
All of our secrets.
Yeah. I guess, no, it's the ritual and kind of consciously pausing, I think. So there's two things. One is making a coffee or making a tea and actually doing it properly, as I would say it. But maybe that's me being a coffee snob.
Yeah.
But, the whole, like, using a manual filter and pouring the water over it and grinding the beans. Yeah, of course, it takes ages compared to putting it in a machine.
Yeah.
And we use a machine 95% of the time. But it's nice to actually sometimes think, okay, I'm going to make this coffee a really manually labor-intensive way, but I'm going to consciously enjoy doing that.
Yeah.
Listening to records is the other thing. Vinyl, it's not the same as just looking something up on Spotify.
Yes. Yeah.
Other streaming services that are available. having to put a record on.
Yeah.
Probably get the dust off it. Put the knee. To me, that is a ritual to sort of pause and take time.
I've recently taken up gardening. I am terrible. Yes, I am so bad. Yes. And I absolutely appreciate that this is a privilege that I have a garden. I didn't always have a garden.
Yeah.
But just that has been also something that's helped me to kind of pause and, just think about things.
And what are you growing?
Oh, my gosh.
Go on.
I am growing badly a collection of different lavender plants because it's the only thing I've managed to keep alive. Everything else is kind of inherited in the garden, and it's more of a, can we preserve this?
Yeah.
I've had to rip out a lot, which has been quite sad because I've got two dogs and they will just snuffle and eat stuff. My dad had a very, very intense job, very, very high pressure. And I once asked him, how do you deal with the stress of that? Because he really was dealing life and death.
Yeah.
His advice was, if you can do something like gardening, do something that takes you out of your mind and the way that you're thinking so that you can focus completely on something else. And I didn't embrace that for a very long time. But now I'm trying to, as I said, though, really badly.
It's quite interesting, though, isn't it, about the gardening? So my mum actually does loads of gardening, has got a massive garden, absolutely loved it. And I subconsciously, I think I associate calmness with that type of thing. So I have tried a little bit of gardening. I've been growing some peppers inside with my kids this year. We've got some coming through, which is quite cool. But the hands thing. So I've heard, and I don't know if you've heard this as well, but there's some science behind it. I can't remember where I've heard it, and I could be getting this completely wrong, but I've heard that if you do exercises or anything where you use both hands, then you're activating both sides of your brain, and actually you can't be distracted, and that you've taken away to other things. So it's actually like doing, so it's again sometimes like doing very hard exercise, or one of the other things I do is like a lot of mountain biking that I like. And when it's quite hard and running downhill or going downhill, or you're like doing trail running downhill, you have to really concentrate. Otherwise you're going to hurt yourself, because you're concentrating so hard in the moment, you're present on it, that actually it's quite mindful, because it's taking you away from other distractions in it. And I've heard that gardening and cooking are the same, because you're using both hands at the same time. So you're kind of fully absorbed and in it. And that's why it's so good. Now, again, I can't remember the exact detail on it, but I think that's some of the reason behind it.
That's really interesting. So
that is interesting. Yeah.
So I don't know, but it's weird though. I know obviously we're chatting about leadership and everything, but I think that when we talk to coach people, we talk to coach the whole people, the whole person, aren't we? Rather than just a situation.
Yeah.
And I do think that, you know, often in kind of like leadership stuff, we don't necessarily look at the whole kind of thing around it. We just often go into this is their situation, this is what it is, rather than taking a bit more of a holistic kind of approach at it. And I'm a bit more interested in the holistic kind of thing. I don't know what you guys take on that is.
I think people are fascinating. Seriously, people are amazing. Yeah. I think just getting the opportunity to understand how somebody else might have thought about or be approaching something is an amazing opportunity. In leadership, you get that if you're really embracing your one-to-ones and you're really listening to your team and, you know, like you genuinely are trying to understand. In the past, I've been quite guarded about elements of my, like, basically the totality of my outside of work persona, because I was worried that it would make me somewhat less professional at work.
Yeah.
I mean, I have two dogs. I live in a village in Yorkshire. And I garden. So it's not particularly sensational or exciting. But in my mind, I was like, I need to keep this very, very, very private.
Yeah.
But over time, I think I've mellowed. And I think people identify more with people who share a bit more of themselves. And I'm not advocating that we should all be sharing the intricate details of every element of our life at work. But I do think sharing a bit more of yourself is good, because people then are like, oh, well, they're human. And then listening to the other people when they share and genuinely listening to learn and remember is pretty powerful.
I tend to agree. I think I probably am naturally a bit of a sharer. I think I probably had to learn maybe to row back a little bit as well. And it's an interesting one, isn't it? So I know certainly when I talk about kind of like my dad and that kind of era of when they were in work, it was, you know, if you were in a leadership role, you wouldn't associate, you wouldn't go out of work with any of your team. You know, you wouldn't share anything about anything. And it's very much us and them type approach. And I think the modern way of leadership is very different. And, you know, psychological safety, I know you're again an expert on this subject, Clem, that actually, you know, I think someone said to me that vulnerability is like the key to trust. And it's and I do genuinely believe that. Mm-hmm. But there is that bit of, can you be too vulnerable at the wrong time and overshare too much? And does that, you know, there's a...
I guess that's balance again, isn't it? Yeah. So I think, your point about not... If you share something about your personal life, there's huge benefits in doing that as a leader. But of course, there's always going to be stuff that we hold totally personal that we don't want to share. And that's absolutely okay. And that's absolutely... So it's not a sort of binary thing that either a leader needs to share everything that's going on in their life or absolutely nothing. There's probably a comfortable middle ground. But I guess what we've just been talking about here, you know, the benefits of things like taking time to make coffee, gardening, these kind of mindful pursuits, if we talk about those as leaders with our teams and at work, and we encourage others to do the same, then they will also get the benefits, which is ultimately for, you know, the benefit of the company and the organization. And it also shows we're human. We're not just sort of work robots that come in and do a job. So, for me, I think it's a really important thing to kind of have that vulnerability, have that sharing of us as people, not just as employees.
Yeah.
Work robots.
Work robots.
Yeah, work robots. That's an interesting phrase, isn't it?
I don't know why that's popped into my head. Why has that come to my mind?
I don't know.
But AI, maybe.
I was actually going to ask
Boston
you.
Those Boston dog things.
But I was going to ask you about AI as well. Which obviously, you're in the data and tech kind of space. Where does AI kind of fit in your world in terms of kind of leadership and teams at the moment?
I think AI is fascinating. Really interesting. I think it's another opportunity for people to learn about. It's a new technology. It's something that we can learn about, try to understand, and then potentially work out how we can use it. I think for leaders working in technology, a phrase that I've heard that I really like is being ambitious but being cautious, like just working on an AI system into a process that actually, you know, you might want to control your data, or the data itself isn't in the state that you need it to be. Or even, for example, when you put an AI into a system that means that ultimately your customers end up stuck in this doom loop of only talking to an AI when they've got a very important problem.
Yeah.
I may or may not have had this experience in the last couple of weeks. It's so frustrating that you end up calling the new business line because you just can't talk to a human. And I think we need to just be careful of that. Like, there still needs to be a human somewhere in this process.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's where I stand on it.
Yeah, I agree. And that doom loop's, yeah, I think we've all been there, you know, whether it's your bank or like a utilities provider or something. It's like, yeah, I'm just talking to robots. I want to actually, yeah, how do we get through to speak to somebody to actually get something sorted? Yeah, I'm with you. I'm fascinated by it, and I'm fascinated by the, you know, the upside and what the benefits could be. But I'm also a little bit scared of kind of what could happen with it as well. But ultimately, I think where I've landed is, you know, using it for kind of repetitive stuff where actually it's going to be better than a human probably will be, and then allowing more time to have great conversations and actually have more human interaction.
Yeah,
that's exactly. Where, you know, in my world, that's what I'd like to do.
Yeah. I think I see it as it's a really useful tool and an incredibly powerful tool. It's a while ago now, but somebody said something about, you know, like when calculators were invented, it didn't put mathematicians out of a job.
Yeah.
You know, you still need people thinking about maths and, but a calculator, incredibly useful tool. So similarly with AI, it's going to help us with, I guess, all sorts of sort of knowledge and analysis type work that we might find takes ages as humans, but or is very laborious and, you know, and so on. So using it for the right purposes is going to be really beneficial, and that frees us up, hopefully, to, again, as you've just got to focus on more of those human type qualities that it's way off kind of being able to do anything, you know. So creativity, empathy, having conversations, thinking holistically, those kind of things with, hopefully we'll get more time to do that, less time of doing the boring stuff.
And I think it's an interesting point that in some ways I think we're probably quite similar in the way that we approach things from quite a human perspective, but clearly there'll be other people who don't. And one of my fears, maybe especially from a leadership perspective, is that people will kind of default to using a bit of AI and then take away some of the bit that they struggle with. You know, certainly we've seen it in the coaching space where there are now AI coaches, which, you know, for me personally, I've had plenty of coaching myself. I was like, the last thing I'd want is a computer giving me the coaching, because I value the interaction piece. But I'm sure there'll be plenty of people who might do it as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether, you know, we'll see like people using AI in their teams, you know, running their one-to-ones for them. And
Got my one-to-one with Alexa.
You see, I think there's a role for organizations in that, because there will be some people who will feel more comfortable using an AI than having a conversation with a human, because humans are nuanced. We've all carrying our own stuff. We're unpredictable.
Yeah.
An organization, I think, understanding the fact that, you know, there is this new technology, it's all very exciting, it has all these capabilities, I think the talking to and proactively engaging with your management teams on how can you use AI as a leader,
yeah,
and what are our standards and what is our tone and our pace around AI, not just from a customer facing systems perspective, but from a leadership perspective. So how can you use AI, but also being open and honest about the fact that one-to-ones, for example, really, we want people to have one-to-ones as humans. So yeah, respectfully, we can use AI for certain things. That's fine. But that does not and should not replace the role of that conversation. And I actually think that setting clear agreements with people, although it might sound a bit, perhaps a bit strict,
yeah,
I think that that helps people know where they're operating and how they should be operating. And I would do it. I would do it. I would be absolutely mortified. And I know for certain that my team are not having one-to-ones with their teams using AI. Retros are still done,
yeah,
using human beings. I do know, however, that my leaders are using AI to cut kind of draft comms and then look at that and improve them. And I love that. I think,
yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
Go,
yeah,
for it.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think the point there on kind of clarity and standards, I wholeheartedly agree with. And I think it's it can be a tricky one sometimes. And I've fallen foul of this in the past, I think, a little bit. When, you know, if you profess to be kind of a people-centric or human-centric leader, sometimes I think that can sound a little soft,
yeah,
and that you'll lean a little bit kind,
yeah,
of left with it. Now, and in a lot of ways, that's a good thing because you care and you have the empathy in. But actually, if you don't have the clarity, if you don't have the standards, if you allow behaviours to kind of slip, or you don't have clear,
yeah,
you know, patterns around it, it can lead to kind of chaos.
Yes,
and also not really being very productive as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I think it's a tricky one to navigate sometimes.
I think you've got to give people the chance to understand the environment that they're working in. And sometimes if that does mean being a bit clearer about certain boundaries, then actually in the long run, that's fairer to people. And I, you know, depending on the team that I've worked in, the maturity of the kind of the leadership team or the group of people or the journey that they're on, I've been more clear about different elements of how do we work together. I've tried to include people in that, but I'm not personally very comfortable with expectations. I prefer agreements. And so having clear agreements with people, I find, is really helpful. Now, the layers of that, you have to be careful with it. As I said, look at the team, but...
And what's the difference between an agreement and an expectation?
Yeah,
I think you were going to ask that.
What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. What's the difference between an expectation and an agreement? Well, I guess how that lands with me, my thought on that would be an agreement is kind of a two-way. So we've both been invested in whatever this thing is. We'll agree this is what we'll do kind of thing. So there's a buy-in from both sides is how I hear agreement. Expectation often sounds like there's something a little bit unsaid.
Yeah.
So maybe there's an expectation that, I don't know, whatever it might be, we will work overtime to hit this project deadline, but nobody's actually stated that. So it's a kind of slightly vague thing. So that, I don't know if that's what you...
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's exactly how I had to think about it. And that's a brilliant example of that. If you have an agreement with a team and you say, look, we've got this thing to deliver, but we're going to approve overtime. And, you know, it would be really helpful if people can work overtime. But the agreement is if you work these extra hours, the overtime will be paid. And expectation is exactly what you just said. It's kind of, and I think that murkiness of, well, I think this and you think that, but we haven't actually had the conversation where we've come together and agreed that actually, you know, that the boundaries are here, then how in the world are we ever going to get to the stage where we both feel kind of satisfied in the sense of we're working together in the way that we should be? And that's why I'm not a fan of expectations.
Yeah.
Agree.
That clarity again,
yeah,
I think, coming
clarity.
Back. Yeah.
It is. And I really like that, actually. And it's maybe one that I'm going to steal a little bit as well. So, and I think we can all be guilty of those kind of unsaid expectations.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the best bits of advice I got actually before we were kind of starting kind of Exalta was around the clarity piece, and actually just be as clear as you can and as transparent as you can with each other, with, you know, with everything that you do. But I think sometimes as you grow a bit and other things happen and, you know, the chaos of business surrounds, it can be hard sometimes to make sure that you're consistently doing that as well. Because it can be at so many different levels.
Yeah.
You know, it could be with a customer, it could be with your internal team, it could be, you know, there's so many different kind of levels to that as I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
So, interesting. Do you have any other kind of things or standards or, you know, things within your team kind of such as that you kind of adhere to? So like personal standards or kind of values or goals that you use to, you know, in a day-to-day running?
Yeah. So our values, actually, so we've always as a team had values, and we specifically called out values. We've also iterated those over time, depending on what it is that at that particular point in time we've been doing. I think there are some that are unspoken now that I think about it, which is interesting, having just had the conversation about expectations and agreements. But there are things that really I didn't feel like we needed to have the conversation about. You know, this is how we work, like communication around. So things like turning up to meetings, if you can't make it, just let people know. I'm going to be completely honest. I'm really in favor of people having their camera on.
Yeah.
Because I like to be able to see how something is landed with people. And also I find it interesting, the scenario of, well, if we were in a meeting room, you know, you would be there. I would be able to see your face, but now we're online. So I am in favor of that. I think things like how we speak to each other and how we work together.
Yeah.
My role at the moment is a functional lead. So it's engineering and test across a function. Mm. I've always tried to work with that team and instill in that team a sense that although there are things that are owned within the different teams, there is an accountability across the function. So all for one and one for all. There has to be a priority in that.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've moved people across teams. We've done this in collaboration with them.
Yeah.
But we've moved managers. We've had people moving across teams. We've spun up new teams. And I like that flexibility and that opportunity of being able to kind of enable people to grow within that wider function. And that's the kind of the gist of, without giving you the list of like our values is kind of where we're at.
Yeah. And I think some of the unsaid ones are around, they're almost manners in some ways.
That's like, true.
So I'm I hate lateness. And I have been known in a previous life to, if people were late to meetings, and I mean more than like a couple of minutes, well, I've locked the door and not let them in.
I just leave the call.
Yeah,
After 5 minutes, I'm out.
Yeah. So I would do that on a, this is an in-person one where, and I genuinely did. I was like, because it was a reoccurring behavior. And I think I think I wanted to make a point, but it's also, there needs to be a consequence for, actually, this is, you know, this is the standard that we set, and actually you're not respecting other people's time as well with it. You know, certainly no phones on in meetings and, you know, things like that as well. So whilst they're probably not said, they're enforced, if that kind of makes sense. So and how you talk to people and you know, the respect one. So we have respect internally. It's after I've talked about this before. We do kind of one-to-ones on a monthly basis, and the values run through part of the performance kind of scheme. And I think it's one that is talked about a lot, and actually what it means to other people as well, because it's an interesting one. Because if you don't have the behaviors aligned against it, then actually what does it, you know, what respect to me might mean a very different thing to you.
Yeah.
So, I find that it's an interesting one.